Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. As Anthony Kim would say, hello haters, I'm back. Many thanks to Steve Sands for filling in on the podcast on Wednesday. I'm not, Rex, quite as appreciative, however, of Hoboski and at MPC77769, who both suggested on YouTube that the show is better off without me. That was deeply hurtful. But anyway, I do digress. In one of the most stunning results of the year, it wasn't Cameron Young. It wasn't Mackenzie Hughes. It wasn't Keith Mitchell who won Sunday at the Valspar Championship. It was Peter Malnati. Peter Malnati. Yellow golf ball, bucket hat, who came away with the two-shot victory. Rex, what'd you take away from this?
I'm glad you opened it with talking about Steve Sands. He was very gracious enough to join the podcast on Wednesday, as our editor put it. Steve Sands has stories. He has a lot of stories. It was actually hard to get him to stop telling those stories. I was taken by two things this week, though, and I do want to get to your question, and I'll circle back around to it eventually. One, you just kind of glossed over it. You really got your feelings hurt. You got all up in your feelings, and do you want to talk it out? Are you okay? Because people kind of came at you, and I keep telling you, don't read the comments, and you don't listen to me.
I do always read the comments. No. I think it's good to get a gauge of what the people are saying. I was not quite expecting that one. That's going to like produce some sort of heel turn for me. I'm going to be quite vengeful, especially to those two commenters in particular. I just found it hurtful. And when I see Steve Sands at the home of the Augustas, when we will all be together in 3 weeks' time, I'll be reminding him of that. Probably not on camera, because those sorts of things, those sorts of funnies don't really go over well.
No, they don't like national. They don't like playtime at Augusta. No, the Augustas.
But I probably won't talk about it off camera with them.
I was taken by the idea, and look, having Steve on so we could clear some air between he and I, and we could tell some stories. That was a lot of fun. Just to pull back the curtain a little bit, Steve cannot be a regular on the podcast because it took me about all day just to sort of narrow him down and finally get him, as everyone saw, in a parking lot talking to me on a phone that he couldn't find anywhere to actually put. So he literally had to hold it for 45 minutes and it was shaking. So it wasn't the best product that we've come out with. And I will say this, and I didn't mention this on the podcast then, but I will say the way the timing worked out, I actually reached out to Todd Lewis. Todd has been on our podcast before.
And he has.
He's very, very good. We have a lot of
great
fun.
Great guest. Love him.
Didn't get back to me in a timely manner. And I'm saying hours, like an hour went by before he got back to me. And I was like, well, all right, I need someone. So then I reached out to Steve. Right after Steve said yes, Todd said yes. So it was such an awkward, weird, uncomfortable situation.
The egos too on these men are extraordinary.
I know.
And so you cannot imagine if I was hurt by what Hoboski and MPC were saying about me, imagine what Tilo's thinking, that his arch rival Steve Sands is the one who's getting the
biggest
on this podcast.
They were. That's actually a funny story. I actually want to have them both on the podcast one day to talk about it. They both were in this market, the Orlando market, and I think Todd was working for Channel 6, the CBS affiliate, and Steve was working. He was the sports director for Channel 2, the NBC affiliate, and they actually were very much competitors back in the day, so there are some fun stories. Now, I did want to touch on that because you seemed to get your feelings really hurt. I wanted to see if you wanted to talk.
That's like the 4 minutes of useless chit-chat that I know you don't read the comments, that the commenters really do not like.
I know.
Which is why I was trying to cut around it.
I had to circle back around because you were clearly hurt by it. And I'm not going to get the name on this, but someone really took a deep dive on, we know what's going on with Lav, because I made some sort of funny remark off the top that you're sitting on a beach with a fancy drink, ignoring your wife and kids. I don't even know if you were ignoring your wife and kids. I assumed you're on a beach. I didn't mean anything by it.
No, my wife was there with me. I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly ignored her at times, but I don't think that's a fair characterization.
Stunned by the finish, and not because Peter Malnati's not a good player. He's won on the PGA Tour, and I don't want to dismiss that. And I want this whole conversation to be about the idea of we're really, really quick to dismiss how hard it is to win on the PGA Tour. But before I get to that, I was watching the early coverage on Thursday, and our friend Todd Lewis was on the early coverage, PGA Tour Live, did a really, really good job. But I was watching Jordan Spieth's round on Friday, and I don't even know, you were traveling, you probably didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it, but it was the most Jordan Spieth of Jordan Spieth rounds. He missed more fairways than he hit. He missed more greens than he hit. And it dawned on me, and this is nothing about the announcers on that telecast or on any telecast, but I just want to see a window. Like, I would like to have the alternate option of just being able to watch Jordan Spieth and just listen to him and Michael Greller as they make their way around the golf course. Because, and I'll give the folks on PGA Tour Live a monsoon of credit, the rule is when a caddy and a player, especially that caddy and that player,
lay out.
You always lay out. The problem is they never stop talking. And like, I'm about 30 minutes into the telecast, and I realized that if you're going to wait for them to stop talking, that you're never going. I mean, you're going to throw it to commercial and take it out of break, and that's going to be the extent of it. And maybe that's what I want to see. Like that, I'm here for all of that.
I would love a Spieth feed. I mean, what does ESPN Plus have? Four different feeds now for your run of the mill PGA Tour event. Just give me a fifth. Give me a Spieth feed. I heard the new PGA Tour studios. I think you got invited to a tour. As did I during Players Championship Week. Obviously, could not make that happen. I have been told they have upwards the capability of having 13 different feeds. PGA Tour Entertainment will beginning in 2025. I think they're starting with 6, capability of moving to 13. Give me a Spieth feed. He remains in both good play and bad, one of the most entertaining players, if not the most entertaining player on the planet. It's actually more interesting when things are going south than actually things are going well. You know, like he flags it, he makes birdie putts, the crowd's into it, he's into it. But like when things are starting to spiral a little bit, like just an absolute content bonanza.
And he was in the trees a lot. He wasn't driving the ball particularly well. You could tell he was in a mood. You could tell Greller wasn't in a mood. Like everything you need to have for that stew to come together was all right there. To circle back around, I was stunned by two things. Apparently, Peter Molinari must have got a ball striking lesson from Yasir Al-Ramayan on Monday in the most important pro-am that the PGA Tour has ever had, because he came out and hit the ball better than he has in years. And up until the very end,
he's been working with Bradley Hughes over the past month.
I know.
Clearly some dividends there.
Something. Yeah, I was being playful because he is a player director and his time is being eaten up by whatever's going on in golf. I was shocked, and I don't expect it. Look, we're not going to have another Johnny Miller. I don't expect anybody to be another Johnny Miller. He was special. He was a once in a generation announcer, but I was kind of taken that no one is willing to take Cameron Young to task on the idea. And for whatever reason, I went back and just did some quick research before we jumped on this pod. On August 16, 2022 in Delaware, all those players got together and started the path that essentially we were on right now. Signature events, big money, limited fields. Where we are right now, it essentially started in that room led by Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy. There was 23 players in that room. Only 3 of them since that date, August 16, 2022, have not won. Cameron Young is one of them, which is shocking to me because you and I can both look at him and objectively say, oh, he's a robot. Like he should win more times than not simply because he doesn't do anything wrong. Even on Sunday, he didn't do anything particularly wrong. Hitting his tee shot way left on set 18 kind of threw me because that's the one part of his game you thought he could depend on. But I'm still blown away by the idea that this player who keeps getting close, he has 7 runner-ups in his career, still hasn't gotten it done.
I mean, okay, so you're glossing over the stat, which has actually now become historic. He has the most runner-ups, 7, of any player without a win on the PGA Tour in the last 40 years. I mean, the previous was 6, and it was Colin Montgomery, who obviously never won on the PGA Tour, and Briony Baird, who he was kind of the Charles Howell before Charles Howell, the Charles Howell who just never wins. Like he just racked up top 5, top 10 finishes. Cameron Young now, in what would be 3 full seasons on the PGA Tour, he has runners up finishes to Max Homa, Joaquin Niemann, Cam Smith, Sam Burns, Tony Finau, and now Peter Molinari. I have to imagine that this one hurt most of all. Cameron Young is not playing as well.
Why? Because it's Cameron Molinari, or because yes, I'm curious because why?
Because it's Peter Molinari. And look, not all runner-up finishes are treated equally. Right? Like there's a couple in there, like the Tony Finau one, like he lost by 5. Joaquin Niemann blew the doors off everybody at Riviera, and Cameron Young
at the Open Championship. That was a bit of a
essentially won the beef flight
runner up as well. Like I think he shot like 64 or something ridiculous on the final day.
This was one of the few chances, realistic chances, that he had to win, and he didn't convert it, and he did it in sort of spectacular fashion, missing out with a wild pull off the tee on the 72nd hole, a, in his words, a fatted gap wedge from the pine straw that to what 40, 50 feet, and then a really poor three putt. When the one mistake you cannot make is to have a three putt and to drop another shot to basically just lay down for Peter Molinari to come in and play the 72nd hole with a two shot lead. I have to imagine that this one hurts the most. Again, he's not playing as well as he did in summer 2022. I'm still shocked that Cameron Young did not walk away with a victory in 2022 based on the way that he had played, the way that he played in the major championships, the way that he played in the regular season events. I think he was 15th strokes gained total that year. He essentially did everything well. He is not at that point, and yet I still think this one hurts of all of the runner-up finishes based on A, the position he was in, and B, the competition that he was going up against head-to-head.
I don't like the second part of that, but I get what you're saying. And I don't, again, I want to circle back around to the idea.
In no world, if you were doing a blind test, you did not know their names, and you saw Cameron Young on the range, and you saw Peter Molinari on the range, which one do you think would win a PGA Tour event, especially at a golf course like Innisbrook that really rewards crisp ball striking?
Well, you and you're leaning into
that those two players.
You're leaning into Peter because he won. I think Matt Hughes needs to be pointed out. He's won multiple times on the PGA Tour. He's a world-class player. You had Adam Hadwin right there in the mix. You had Xander Schauffele right there in the mix. I mean, there was plenty of
65 to backdoor it. It was Keith Mitchell who imploded. It was
imploded. Oh my!
I almost called him Seamus Power, who was also in the final group. He also imploded on the final day. You had Phillips, who hadn't been in that position. He's a rookie on the PGA Tour. It was setting up for a Cameron Young victory. There is no doubt about it.
I felt like you're right. That's why I was so taken by what was said on the telecast afterwards. And look, these are colleagues of ours, and I'm not being overly critical because it is hard on the other side. I don't want to dismiss how hard it is to win on the PGA Tour. And I don't want to make it seem like, well, Cameron Young should have won seven times by now in his career, because it's really hard. And to say something like that, I don't think people understand how difficult it is. All they see is, well, Tiger Woods did it. Well, he was touched by the hand of God. He was otherworldly. Like, that's not ever a fair comparison. But when you're Cam Young and you have all those tools that you just talked about, and look, his putting, it seems like the thing that's held him back the last few months. But when you hit the ball as well as he does, and Scottie Scheffler is the perfect example. If he needs a paradigm of hope, just look at Scottie Scheffler. If you can do that week in and week out, then eventually your putting is going to come around. You're going to figure something out and you're going to win. The fact he hasn't done it, I think, is, well, it's twofold. One, it's sort of a testament to, again, how hard it is to win on the PGA Tour. And two, something's missing. Like, and I don't pretend to sit here and know what it is with Cam Young. Like, I don't, you can say it's his putting. Well, that's really easy. And okay, then maybe he needs to do something else. But there is a gear, there is a gene, there's something in his DNA that's missing that he hasn't been able to break through by now. We've seen it in the past where these ultra-talented players figure it out eventually. I think David Duval is probably a best example. And once he started winning, he won in bunches and won a major and got to world number one. And I can see that happening to Cam Young. But the fact it hasn't happened now, it deserves a critical eye. It deserves something a little bit more than, well, it just wasn't his week. Because you're right. It absolutely 100% was his week.
So as it relates to Cam Young, my biggest takeaway actually was more about Scottie Scheffler, and that Scottie Scheffler's dominance and his through-the-bag completeness has kind of shined a light on some of the glaring weaknesses of some of his competition. You know, just this week, you look at Justin Thomas. We're going to get to Justin Thomas and his putting performance. He lost seven strokes in the field. Like his putting, he's now one of the worst putters on the PGA Tour. You mentioned Jordan Spieth earlier in this podcast. Why is Jordan Spieth not winning as much as he was earlier in his career? Well, he makes a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, he's got some deficiencies. Like
he makes a lot of mistakes. You look at the rest of the world ranking. Rory McIlroy has not had his best stuff this season. His approach play has not been particularly sharp. Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay, they haven't won in nearly 2 years on the PGA Tour. Max Homa, it doesn't hit the ball high enough in major championships and have sort of that aspect to his game as well. Like, you can go down the list and start to nitpick. And now, if Scottie Scheffler and his putting has seemingly been fixed overnight, or at least over the past 7 months with Phil Kenyon, he doesn't really have that sort of glaring deficiency that a lot of his peers do. And in Cameron Young, yes, it is a severe weakness in Cameron Young's game that he either does not pitch and chip the ball well or putt the ball well. He is an extraordinary driver of the golf ball. He can hit his irons as high as anyone, and he can get really, really hot. However, at this level, when the margins are so small, we're talking the elite, elite level, you know, top 10, top 15, top 20 players in the world. When you have this sort of glaring deficiency, it means you have to have almost a perfect week to beat the Scottie Schefflers that are seemingly poised to now dominate on the PGA Tour.
I felt like he was on the verge of a breakthrough when Paul DeSorey picked up his bag. I think Paul went straight from Webb Simpson, if I'm not mistaken, and went straight to Cameron Young's bag. And I felt like that was such a good move on his part because Paul is a lot of things. He's a really, really steadying force. Like we've seen it throughout the decades with Webb Simpson. He also is really smart when it comes to the golf swing. He's really smart when it comes to playing the game of professional golf. And I thought if he could pick someone and put him on his bag and get, you know, 3 percentage points better overnight, that was going to be it. The fact they're not together anymore, and I've yet to talk to Paul about this, so this isn't any
Cam Young has cycled through at least two caddies since the split with Paul DeSorey. He's clearly just trying to find what the missing piece is.
And it's hard to sit here and be overly critical, to circle back around, simply because if you put yourself in contention to win a PGA Tour event, which he did, which he has done, as you pointed out, 7 times he's finished runner-up on the PGA Tour, you're clearly talented. You're plenty good enough to be on the PGA Tour. You're plenty good enough to have won multiple times on the PGA Tour. That doesn't dismiss the idea or the fact that something's missing, that he and his dad, who's a swing coach, need to go back to the drawing board and figure out exactly what it is that's happening on a Sunday afternoon, like this Sunday afternoon, when everything was heading in your direction. You didn't have to be a superstar. This is perfect Nick Saban time. Like, I don't need you to be a hero. Just do your job. And in this particular case, 2 pars probably would have been enough, because then he probably would have pressed Peter. They probably would have finished up in a tie. And I like Cam Young's chances in a playoff against Peter Molinari, if I'm being honest. So I just think at this point, you have to take a hard look in the mirror, and that's hard after a week like this.
I thought he put it well in his seemingly short post-round scrum. He said it was a, quote, bad time for a bad one as it relates to his drive in the 72nd hole, which went way, way left. And secondly, when they were asked to kind of sum up his emotions just a couple minutes after signing his card and realizing that he was not going to win for the first time of the PGA Tour, he said, quote, I have a 4-hour drive home with a 1- and 2-year-old. So whatever emotions are attached to that, I felt that one intimately as a father of 2 young children as well. This was a very roundabout way, Rex, to get into a discussion about Peter Melnati's victory and the fact that he had a near flawless back nine. He nearly came home in 30. He felt like he wished it in with a birdie putt on 12. He obviously got a really lucky break with the free drop behind the green on 16, that would have been a very gnarly lie.
No, that was good sound. And he called it. Like, look, I know this is a good break. I want to make sure this is right.
Yes. He brought over Steve Rentoul and said, look, I know how this is going to look, but I just want to make sure that I am entitled to this free drop. But obviously he took advantage and got up and down and saved par. And then he hit what I thought was an amazing 5-iron into 17 to make birdie to give him at least the initial cushion. And then a really crisp shot out of the fairway bunker on 18. If he fats that one, bringing all sorts of trouble. If he thins that one, raising all sorts of trouble. Instead, knocks about 20 feet past the pin and is able to really savor this. Like he was already choking up and tearing up on the edge of the green before he was even in the house on the 72nd hole. So I guess my question to you, Rex, is as it relates to Peter Melnati, is this proof that the PGA Tour still needs opportunities for full field events, essentially for guys like Peter Melnati?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, I think we've seen that already this season. I don't think we needed Peter to win this one, but we're going to continue to see it. Like, the full field events still serve a purpose, and that's to create pathways for the up-and-coming players, which Peter Melnati does not fit in that category, but certainly Nick Dunlap does, and we can go back over the course of the season and start pointing to guys that, yes, like, you cannot, it's the Jason Gore line that the commissioner used last week. The PGA Tour creates stars in 3 weeks. Maybe if those players can get into the right fields and play 3 good weeks, that does happen. But to do that, you have to have some sort of pathway. And so that's what they've done here. And I also will say, as bad as I thought it was going to be with a larger field, I think there was 156 in the field last week. They expanded it, trying to create more playing opportunities because of the playing opportunities the PGA Tour has taken away with the new season. I would imagine that they were still trying to play catch up Sunday afternoon, but they were not. And so I don't think it's nearly and I kind of pointed this out in my column on Friday, there is a clear delineation right now between the have and the have-nots. You just look at the world ranking points, and you can forget about all the flaws and the warts. Just look at the actual numbers. Like, all right, we know that the world ranking is not a good representation of who the best players in the world are, but you can get an idea of how good fields are relative to each other. And these fields, this field in particular, was not the best in Florida. It was ranked fourth out of the four Florida swing events. I would argue it was probably, I don't want to call it the best finish, because I still think Scottie Scheffler and what happened at the Players Championship was probably the best finish, but it was close. Yeah, but it was close. I think it was compelling TV. I think the golf course itself is the one that kind of shines in that particular situation. I think once players get on it, I had two or three people text me and ask, could Innsbruck hold a major? And my reply is always the same. Yeah, if they tore down everything around it and rebuilt that old resort and everything that's around it, like it's dated, but the golf course itself is fantastic. And if you wanted to hold the U.S. Open in March, it'd be perfect. But to answer your question, yes, I think what we've seen out of these events, the cliche, they are what we thought they were.
I think the full field events have actually been a big hit on the PGA Tour. And yet I still find myself kind of torn about this as you think about the future of the PGA Tour. I personally love these stories like Peter Malnati's. He's clearly just like a delightful golf nerd. If you listen to his press conference, like the appreciation that he has to be able to play on the PGA Tour, the thankfulness that he has for, you know, the title sponsor and the area, like he's a really kind-hearted individual that makes it really easy to cheer for him. He clearly is a great family man. Loves his wife, appreciative of his wife. Like, I think he has a really good perspective. And yet, I still can't help but think that if the PGA Tour is looking at its product, you would not want a player like Peter Malnati. Not necessarily Peter Malnati, the person. I'm talking about Peter Malnati, the player. Here are Peter Malnati's FedEx Cup ranks in his PGA Tour career since he started in 2014. 178, 104, 167, 161, 118, 137, 86, 101, and 116. In other words, this is a player who year in and year out struggles to keep his PGA Tour card, even in the years that he does. He's a player who, if you listen to Roy McIlroy, and the tour is going to get more aspirational, the tour is going to get more cutthroat, he is most likely to be left out. He's likely to hear he's one of the mules, the angry mules who's fighting first place, or the quote unquote fat that's going to be trimmed. And now, you know, he's clearly fighting for that position and to maintain kind of his footing on the PGA Tour. That's why his peers voted him on the PGA Tour policy board, essentially to fight for the rank and file against the Tigers and the Cantlays and the Spieths and so forth. But you could make the argument, Rex, that for the future of the PGA Tour, whether that's 2025, 2026, 2020, 2030, whatever the case may be, that a player like Peter Malnati should not be on the PGA Tour, that he is weakening the product because he's not one of the best players in the world. Do you buy that argument?
No, I don't buy that. I mean, he just beat a field that was pretty good. It had Jordan Spieth in it. It had Justin Thomas. It had Xander Schauffele. It had Cam Young. It had enough stars, big name players in this field for you to look at this and be like, yeah, like he certainly deserves to be on the PGA Tour. This is his second PGA Tour victory. I don't think that's a fair comparison, just because you're looking at the name as you're kind of looking at it as a punchline. I feel like, not to put words in your mouth.
No, I'm saying if this was a blind resume and you looked at his FedEx Cup rank over the past decade, you would say this is the type of player that the future PGA Tour should be trying to weed out. A guy who is coasting either on past champion status or is going through the Korn Ferry Tour or the Korn Ferry Tour Finals, or needs to go through Q School, or makes a late run at the Wyndham Championship to save himself. Like, that's the sort of player that we're talking about. Peter Malnati is just a name. I'm talking blind resume. If those are your results, Do you belong on this new version of what the PGA Tour can and should be?
Well, no, because you're not asking the right question. But to your point, no, he wasn't one of the 23 players in the room in Delaware. I guess to your point, he's never showed up on one of the pip lists. Like, no, he's not one of the cool kids by any stretch of the imagination. However, there has to be some element of meritocracy involved here. I understand what Rory's saying. I understand where you're going. However, if we're just heading in the direction of LIV Golf, where we're going to handpick the 48 players, best 48 players in the world, and just ride with them, then you're going to end up being in the same position LIV Golf is going to be in a few years. You're just going to have you're going to have a bunch of old 48-year-old players who are past their prime. And that's why you have to have some sort of infusion. That's what the Swing 5 and the Swing 10, that's what those are all about. And we talked about this last week on the podcast at the Players Championship. If the churn rate is what the tour says it is, and I think it was 40%, so it's about 20 players right now falling out of and moving into that top 50. If that is what happens, and I'm still a little dubious that's what's going to happen, that's the meritocracy we were talking about. And you're going to end up having a Peter Malnati in that group. Whether if you like it or not, there's going to be, I mean, I would throw Lucas Glover in there as another perfect example, because that's kind of the player you're talking about right now. That's not entirely fair because Lucas did win a major championship, but I get what you're saying. And without those players sort of cycling in and out of that top 50, you're going to end up with a very stale product. I think even though the PGA Tour is trying to lean into this concept of we have to make a tour for the stars, about the stars, I get it. I understand where we're at in this moment in time. You still have to provide that pathway. And whether if that's going to be full field events and you have these Aeon Swing 5 and 10 events, or you expand whatever the Korn Ferry Tour is into something bigger and you create a pathway that way. However it is you do this, you do have to create that pathway.
I don't even know if it's necessarily a pathway, because that could just be kind of a 1 week in and 1 week out type situation. I'm talking if the PGA Tour closes its doors and they make it a 75 player tour, and it wouldn't even be called the PGA Tour. Let's call it the World Tour.
What do you mean by closing the doors? I don't understand what you're saying.
I'm saying if they take the top 50 from the FedEx Cup list in 2024, and that now is part of this World Tour, and you take the top 10 guys from LIV, you take the top 10 guys from the DP World Tour, and you take a couple of guys from the Australasian Tour, or the South Africa Tour, like if that's how you're going to be compiling your World Tour, okay, and they're just closing their doors and you're leaving out those players, and those are the players, to use your phrase, that you're riding with for the remainder of the year. I get it. I think there's a potential that could really backfire, and that people just get sick of seeing the same players over and over again. The players like Peter Malnati on the PGA Tour, I think they provide context for how extraordinary a Scottie Scheffler is, how kind of long-winded these journeys can be in professional golf, that it's not just like Ludwig Oberg, who comes out and wins within his first couple months as a PGA Tour pro, or like Tom Kim, who comes out and already has a couple of PGA Tour wins to his credit by the age of 21. They provide context that it's not just this linear path to superstardom. So I think the PGA Tour would do well to continue to remind themselves of that contrast. I think that's compelling. Again, is the Valspar Championship going to be the highest rated tournament of the year? Cannot imagine. When the ratings come out on Monday or Tuesday, I cannot imagine. And yet I still think it's an essential piece of the PGA Tour to show that it's not just about the stars, and that there's plenty of depth, there's still plenty of parity, and there's still plenty of pathways or journeys that can get to the level of winning on the greatest golf tour in the world.
Well, and the storytelling element of it. So after Peter, and look, he has an interesting story to tell. If you don't have to venture too far down the leaderboard to run into a Ches Reavy or an Aaron Baddeley. I have no idea how he was even in that field. I mean, these are players, as you just pointed out, who have.
So that's actually a problem. Aaron Baddeley, I don't know how he's in the field.
I don't know.
That is exactly what the PGA Tour is trying to shift away from, is it not?
Not at these events, but yes, at the events you're talking about. And look, the schedule you just concocted in your mind of what the World Tour schedule is, I'm fine with that. Because at the end of the year, you're going to have X number of those players out of the top 50 who are going to get relegated, and X number are going to get promoted. Like, that's the idea. It's not going to be a closed shop. And it's not going to be four players every year. And please don't come at me, Liv Bots. I don't have an interest in this fight right now. But clearly that wasn't good enough for the world ranking. And I think most people watching from the outside will tell you, well, no, that's really not promotion and relegation. Like, that's not the way it really works, at least not in golf. If you promote and relegate 20 players out of that 50 every year, yeah, I think it will refresh the product. And it will give you an opportunity to allow those young players who we have seen now come back. You talk about Ludwig. You talk about Victor Hovland the last few years. You talked about Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth before that. It will allow them the pathway, but it'll also allow when you will inevitably end up with a Peter Malnati. And I hate, I'm like, we're just beating up. He's catching a lot of strays after winning on a Sunday night. I hate kind of doing this because I don't want to dismiss the fact either. You and I both have talked with enough members of player directors on the policy board. And we both have an idea of how time consuming those jobs are right now. You're spending hours, not minutes, hours every week listening to proposals and sitting through meetings. And on Monday, of course, he spent all day long with the governor of the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of pressure. There was a lot of distractions for him to do that. I would have bet you a lot of money. And I'm not a gambler because I'm not very good at it. But I would have bet you a lot of money that none of those six player directors were going to win this year on the PGA Tour.
I mean, isn't it amazing that of the ones who has factored deep on Sunday and then won, it was Peter Malnati who did it?
Man, he's just
kidding. Like, is that not amazing? So I guess, but what do you think? Like, will Peter Malnati now be more emboldened in these policy board meetings? Because to a Patrick Cantlay, to a Jordan Spieth, probably even to a Tiger Woods, like they probably scoff at Peter Malnati's career achievements, right? Like his lone PGA Tour win was the 2015 Sanderson Farms. It was in the fall. It didn't come with a Masters invite. Like he's going to be making his Masters debut in a couple weeks' time. Like these are all superstar players, at least they have been at some point in their career. And they know what Peter Malnati stands for. They know what he represents. They know who he is fighting for. And that's the rank and file of the B class on the PGA Tour. But with this victory now, Rex, do you think Peter Malnati now carries more weight in those meetings as they're helping to reshape the future of the PGA Tour?
Yeah, you think the conversation is going to be, well, Tiger, when I won in Tampa, the way it worked out there was. You think that's the way that conversation?
No, but I'm saying...
No, I don't.
But I'm saying this is a prime example of what Peter Malnati is fighting for. Deeper fields, full field events, access now to the majors, access now to the signature events for the rest of the season without a sponsor exemption, which obviously he was criticized for earlier this year. This can be held up now as a shining example of why the PGA Tour should be a certain way.
Sure. Yeah, I will go with that. And Peter Malnati stepped in right as Charlie Hoffman was coming off the board. So he does represent a segment of the PGA Tour, to your point, the lower third, let's call him, whatever nomenclature you want to throw on them. He represents that portion of them. And there has always been, even when there were only four policy board player directors on the policy board, there was always one that sort of stood out. Joe Ogilvie, when he was on the board, was that person, because there was always going to be the Tiger Woods and the Davis Loves who are also on the board, and they represent sort of the star power on that front. I will, and again, I hate that Peter's catching a lot of strays on the Sunday that he actually won, but I will say he didn't come across very well last week at the Players' Championship when we talked to him about the meeting on Monday that was coming up with him and the representatives from the PIP. He didn't come across well then. I've read some comments that he made last week in Tampa. I don't feel like he came across well then, because he keeps
a little naive, a little ignorant, what?
A little naive, yes. And here's a player, to your point, his lane is to represent that lower third of the tour, for lack of a better term. And I remember having this conversation with Rory McIlroy when he first went on the board, and about he was going to struggle with the idea of realizing that what's good for Rory is not always good for the rest of the PGA Tour. And he was trying to walk that fine line before he resigned. For Peter, what's best for Peter normally is what's best for sort of that segment of the PGA Tour population that he represents. And when he makes a statement that he says that maybe things went too far after June 6th, as far as player empowerment, and maybe we need the pendulum to swing back the other way, I disagree. Never before have the players in the history of the PGA Tour, maybe in the history of professional sports, been given such a gift as they were given by the PGA Tour because of what happened. They knew there was going to be a revolt, and the commissioner essentially lost the majority on the policy board is what happened. He added a fifth member, and then he added Tiger Woods as sort of a permanent sixth member. That gave the players the vote to approve or not approve whatever it is they wanted to do. That's an important aspect of this. I'm not saying the players need to be in on these meetings combing over spreadsheets. We all agree that that's not what they should be doing, but this is a member organization, and for someone like Peter, who is in that lane for a purpose, to make a comment like that, I felt like was naive is probably the best way for me to say it.
The thought of Peter Malnati sauntering into the next PGA Tour policy board meeting with Tiger Woods and Patrick Cantlay, looking them square in the eye and saying, I'm the captain now.
Yeah.
Me. That's that image is going to sustain me for foreseeable future. I've had
a chance to speak with Peter about these things, about weighty issues, and I find him to be very thoughtful, and I find him to be very studied, for lack of a better term. However, I would say that all six player directors probably feel overwhelmed in these meetings because, as we've said, none of them are qualified to be in there. You and I aren't qualified to be in there. Like, this is a very unique skill set that only a handful of people in the world, I would assume, know how to negotiate multi-billion dollar deals that span the globe. So it's I'm sure, a very, very difficult situation for them to be in. I will say that he comes across to me sometimes as someone who just is thankful to be in the room.
Again, and to my previous point, and it's not even a point. It's more of a discussion topic. Like, is that player the best embodiment of what a future PGA Tour product should look like?
Are we doing this tomorrow on the roundtable on Golf Today? Is this what you're going to pitch? We're going to beat up on Peter Malnati for two segments?
But it's at least a topic of discussion, I think, just based on his career. And this will be held up as a referendum or a prime example of why the Valspar Championships still need to exist, why Peter Malnati, who has fought for his card over the past decade, still deserves a spot to play on the best tour in the world. Rex, before we get out of here, one thing from the Valspar Championship I did want to touch on was the play of one Justin Thomas. He was in a share of the lead early Saturday and ended up plummeting down the leaderboard, wound up in a tie for 64th. He did shoot that 79 in the third round, where, as I mentioned, he lost more than seven shots to the field on the greens. By any statistical metric, one of the worst putting performances in PGA Tour history per round. And I think it's an interesting topic now with the Masters just two full weeks away. Justin Thomas seemed to be rounding into form early in 2024, and yet he will enter the Masters, presumably if he does not add the Valero Texas Open, with a miscut, a T12, a miscut, and now a T64 in his last four starts. Where are you on the JT stressometer?
Pretty high, only because normally when we have these conversations, I'm always really quick to point out that, well, he struggled relative to the rest of the field. Like, if you want to do, you know, putting stats, he was 67th out of 68 of the best players in the world. It's not good when you're 67th out of 68, but it's relative to the rest of the field. What he did on Saturday was bad by any measure. Like, if you and I were playing golf with him on Saturday, I think we both would have walked off and been like, man, that was a bad putting round. Watching it, there was no easy way to try to explain, okay, well, he's working on something, or the greens are really, really slick. Like, look,
he had like 25 feet made worth of putts in the third round. That's almost impossible.
I mean, it is concerning. Only because if you look at what he's doing ball striking wise, I go back to what you said, start the conversation. I do feel like he's rounded the corner. I do feel like I actually saw him hit some wedge shots that look like the JT of old, the JT when he's playing some of his best golf, where he's on, and if it's not inside 5 feet, that he's going to be angry about that. And that's what makes him so special. When he puts that badly, though, and he doesn't seem to be clued into a fix, even throughout Scotty's struggles over the last 12 months, it always seemed like he was searching for something. It always seemed like he had a game plan, whether that was you or I talking to Randy Smith, or when he went to Phil Kenyon, or he and Ted Scott were working on something, or there was a new putter in the bag. He was always trying to do something else, because doing the same thing over and over again, definition of insanity. It doesn't seem like JT's trying to do anything, which is kind of the frightening part, because this isn't something that's just going to fix itself overnight. Like, I do think that when you have a putting round that bad, what he did on Saturday, that there's some sort of deficiency. And I will say, I kind of beat up some of our colleagues in the booth. I will say, I thought Brad Faxon's thoughts were really good. And JT lives in South Florida, and I would reach out to Brad.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. JT has had a couple of putting coaches over the past couple of years. He had Matt Killen for a while. He was with John Graham for a while. Started with him in 2020 and parted ways within the past year or year and a half, it's clear that he needs a second set of eyes from someone. Something. He's never been a particularly strong putter. He's never been an elite putter like his good buddy Jordan Spieth, and yet he's never been quite this poor, quite in need of fixing to this extent. You know, he was already outside the top 150 in strokes gained putting before this putting performance, which again was one of the worst on record for the PGA Tour. I can only imagine what it's going to look like when his stats are updated on Monday morning. I'd love to see it, and it is certainly concerning with that respect, especially with the Masters just around the corner. Because when you look at Justin Thomas's performance in the major championships, and obviously I know that he won in Tulsa a couple of years ago, he has just two top tens, Rex, since the November Masters in 2020. It's been a lot of face plants in golf's biggest events. And I think a prime example was last year at the Masters, where he shot 78 in the second round when he was at least in contention early days there. And when you pinpoint what the issues are, it's not his short game, which is one of the best in the world. As an iron player, his father has got him back on the right track. He's one of the preeminent iron players of his generation. He drives the ball well. It's his putting inconsistency from round to round and week to week that has befuddled JT, and I think has largely slowed his momentum. I'd love to see him make some sort of change, have some sort of addition to his team, because it does seem badly warranted.
164th in strokes gained putting after Valspar. It only got worse. And it is curious to me, because I think when he started working with Bones, going back to the caddy, I felt like that was a really good move. Because I love Jimmy Johnson, his old caddy, but I felt like Bones had been in situations enough with Phil that there was nothing that was going to surprise him. And that's sort of the steadying hand I felt like JT needed at that point in his career. But listening to their interaction, especially on Saturday when things clearly weren't going well, I don't know, you probably haven't been on social media because you're trying to steer clear of it. JT got beat up pretty bad because of the way he acted on Saturday on the golf course. And look, things were going poorly, but when you have all of social media noticing, that's when it becomes a problem.
No bueno. We'll see if he gets it sorted out in the next 2 weeks before he heads to Augusta National. Anything else, Rex, from the week that stood out to you before we turn the page in the preview edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav on Wednesday, previewing the Houston Open, where world number one Scottie Scheffler will be back in the field.
When you made it back on Friday, anything on the grill this weekend?
Let's see. I did some chicken thighs. I kind of need to do a little bit of a detox. Puerto Rico was phenomenal. Mofongo, I'd never had it before.
So good. Delicious. It's
fantastic. Great drinks. Great people in Puerto Rico. It was super easy. I think I'd been there for like a day on like a cruise going to I went to San Juan for 3 or 4 days. But like, it's a U.S. territory, U.S. currency. I mean, the people by and large speak English. Like, it could not be easier. Super clean. Really enjoyed it. It was like a mix between like Miami Beach, St. Augustine, and New Orleans. Like, I thought downtown San Juan, old San Juan, was really cool.
Okay. You didn't ask me, but thanks for asking. I did chili tonight, but I made a pork butt yesterday. So we had pulled pork sandwiches yesterday, and I used the rest of it for chili tonight. Bueno.
Look at you firing up. Mm. It was quite chilly in Northeast Florida, but great barbecue weather. We'll be back in a couple days, as mentioned, for the preview edition of the Houston Open on this Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. In the meantime, you guys know the drill. mcsports.com/golf for all your latest golf needs. Rex and I will be on Golf Today on Monday, 12:05 p.m. Eastern time, for our usual roundtable discussion. Supposedly talking for two segments in a one-hour show about what we don't really know.
Peter Malnati, apparently. In.
Yeah, we probably will talk about Peter Malnati, just as we talked about him on this very podcast. But as always, thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days.